From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Oh. I think I just lost my guest. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to be back with retired Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters. You know Ralph Peters as a Fox News analyst, a retired Lieutenant Colonel of the U.S. Army, and an outspoken advocate for the military. And we're going to do that in just a second here on the Dana Pretzer Show.
We'll be back with more of the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio.
Are you an embarrassment on the dance floor? Do you confuse state capitals, make runny scrambled eggs, and read too many celebrity gossip magazines? Do you drink milk straight from the carton, think trigonometry is a planet, and snore louder than a Kodiak bear? Well, if you answered yes to any of the above questions, you may have what it takes to adopt a teen from foster care.
Okay, we're back. Ralph Peters is a best-selling, prize-winning author who writes under his own name, and as Owen Perry, a former career soldier and old-fashioned adventurer, his military novels have thrilled readers with their unprecedented realism. Well, this nonfiction work has shaped the thinking of a generation of soldiers, and it's a big thrill to have Colonel Peters on the program tonight. Of course, you'll know him as an analyst on Fox News on many of the programs there. Welcome to the program, Colonel.
Hey, great to speak to you. Please call me Ralph.
Okay, Ralph. Listen, I grew up in a military family. I'm a sworn police officer besides doing this show for 27 years, so I respect anyone who puts their life into public service, whether it's military, police, whatever it is. So I do applaud you for your career and your service, and thank you for that. What I see here in the last, well, I'll be quite honest with you, since Barack Obama was elected president, is I see a political correctness in the military that, quite frankly, my late father, who retired as a major, and myself would make me sick. It's just disgusting. Let's talk about it. Let's get into, I want to start with some of these Gitmo detainees and 9/11 terrorists, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and being tried in New York City. They're going to give them the stage that they've always wanted, and it's just disgusting. Am I totally wrong?
No, you're right. And certainly political correctness in the military is worsening under President Obama, but it's been a problem for a long time. It's the roots of political correctness in our military, sad to say, go very, very deep. But on the subject of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the arch-terrorist and his barbershop quartet of fellow terrorists from Guantanamo going to Manhattan, you're absolutely right. This is a terrible decision. It's a win-win for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and a lose-lose for the United States. If Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is indeed convicted in a smooth trial, he gets to be a martyr. And if indeed he's able to stymie the forces of American justice, to have his lawyers argue for mistrials and changes of venue and to exclude evidence and reveal our intelligence work and how it's done, he wins that way too. I think the Obama's administration's decision to move the trial to New York instead of having it under military jurisdiction actually reflects a very deep prejudice among Obama's set against our military. There's a very strong anti-military sentiment. But beyond that, these people live in a dream world. And the notion that you've heard ballyhooed, that this trial in Manhattan in a civilian court will showcase the virtues of the American judicial system, is absolute nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
Because, one, the terrorists are and their lawyers will turn it into a circus. But, two, people believe what they want to believe. And people in the greater Middle East and Muslims are not going to sign up for the American narrative. The terrorists are going to establish their version of events, their narrative. and it's going to be that the Americans are unjust, that it's a kangaroo court, that it's anti-Muslim. And I'll tell you, Dana, just wait and see. This trial, even if it is executed with judicial perfection, unlikely as that may be, is going to be a farce in the eyes of the world. It's a very, very bad idea. I see no upside for the United States whatsoever.
Well, you would think that with the disaster of the trial of the blind sheikh, the first one who was implicated in the first World Trade Center bombing, and again, I use the term stage, where the terrorists are able to spout their virtues, and believe me, they'll have some dopey lawyer that will be representing them that will use the media to its advantage, and someone who works with the media as much as you do, Ralph, how do you see the media? Because there's a lot of political correctness in the mainstream media right now, and it's just as bad as everyone else. How do you see them handling this?
Well, the media will report every breathless charge and every step of the trial, and it will be taken for gospel overseas. If the media reports that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed made this charge or his lawyer made this charge, what the people overseas will hear was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had this done to him, or his lawyer said that this was done to him. So it's very much a matter of perception. But again, I simply see no upside. The curious thing is that one thing extreme leftists, such as those in the Obama administration, don't grasp is that military tribunals, military courts martial, actually tend to be very just, more fair. They're far less subject to emotion than civilian jury trials. And, of course, the advantage for the United States is, one, we're not pretending that these creatures, these monsters, these terrorists, are entitled to the full rights of American citizens, even though the court-martial would treat them fairly, the tribunal. And secondly, in a military tribunal, the judge does have more latitude to decide which evidence can be admitted, and also more latitude in terms of protecting intelligence sources and methods. And that's very important in these cases, because the terrorists are going to try very hard to expose as much of our intelligence system as possible.
Yeah.
I mean, this is going to get very, very ugly. And I'm not arguing for military tribunals because the result would be a foregone conclusion or because they're kangaroo courts. On the contrary, military tribunals are where these murderers, these butchers, these soldiers of Allah belong.
When you see and when you hear reports, and the military man that you are, sir, of combatants on the battlefield being having to be read their Miranda rights when captured, suggestions through this administration, and all this sort of nonsense, for lack of a better term, how does that make you feel?
Well, it just makes me shake my head in sadness, because elevating enemy combatants, who, by the way, are not legal combatants because they declined to wear uniforms or identifying badges. They were illegal combatants in that they didn't have uniforms, identifying marks. These are terrorists. They are below the status of formal enemy combatants. And yet the Obama administration is elevating them above the status of enemy combatants, giving them the same rights we give to our own citizens. This is absolute madness. And at the same time, of course, we have Attorney General Eric Holder looking to prosecute CIA operatives who did their best to keep us safe. So we're granting more rights to terrorists and threatening to prosecute our defenders. This again, I go back to the word madness. This is madness.
Yeah, and it goes from the minimal, I consider, the giving Guantanamo detainees flu pandemic needles, and Joe Public, who's looking for one for he and his family in the United States, can't get them. It's just absolutely crazy, and you and I could do a whole hour on that show. If you're just tuning in, retired Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters is here. You'll know him as a best-selling author and a Fox News military analyst. Let's get right into Fort Hood. NBC News, you can't get much more left than them, especially MSNBC, called the Fort Hood shooting a tragedy, and tragedy, it's a terrorist attack, plain and simple. If there was ever a case of dropping the ball, the military did it with this major, and I want to analyze that with you. Let's get into Fort Hood.
Well, certainly it was an Islamist terrorist act, period. No question about it, no qualifications, no excuses. Major Hassan was an Islamist terrorist. He was self-manufactured, well, certainly with some help from his radical mullahs and the Saudi money that pours into mosques in the United States. But ultimately, he was an Islamist terrorist who formed himself. And increasingly, Islamist terrorism isn't just about, you know, the master plan of al-Qaeda. It's entrepreneurial. There are local franchisees. And that's what we saw with Major Hassan. That's what the military calls mission-type orders. He heard the jihadi mission, and he decided to act to the best of his abilities. Now, you also heard from MSNBC and CNN and others that, well, he was harassed. Big lie.
Yeah.
He was disturbed. Well, look, you can be very disturbed emotionally and mentally and still be a terrorist. I don't think most suicide bombers are from the middle of the bell curve emotionally or psychologically. I mean, it's a false dichotomy to say that, oh, he was disturbed, he was upset, he was tormented, therefore he couldn't be a terrorist. Most terrorists are not happy campers. Terrorists are emotionally disturbed,
yeah. But
that doesn't make them less monstrous, less heinous. And, of course, then you heard the excuse that, oh, well, what's the difference between Major Hassan and Timothy McVeigh? Well, one difference is that Timothy McVeigh did not stand on the street corner in Oklahoma City shouting, "This bomb's for Jesus."
Right.
Motivation does matter. Hassan clearly thought he was doing his duty as a Muslim, as a jihadi. And this is not an indictment of all Muslims in America or all Muslims in our military. On the contrary, it's an indictment of one man who was a Muslim terrorist. And I make it clear, I do not want to see a witch hunt against Muslims who serve in the military. I'm
no.
glad any honest citizen serves in our military.
Yeah.
I just want Muslim soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines to be held to the same standards as everybody else. And the problem with Hassan over the years was because he was a protected minority, you know, a Muslim army psychiatrist and officer, he kept sliding by
because
of our affirmative action policies. Nobody wanted to take this guy on. So again, the Army should be, everybody in uniform should be green, the same color. They're all in the Army or the other services.
Yep.
Treat them all fairly. But nobody should get a free pass when they're communicating with terrorists by email, praising suicide bombers on the Internet, preaching Islam to their patients, trying to get their patients accused of war crimes, arguing with fellow doctors and staff members about the injustice of American policy, and giving classes on the duty of Muslims to behead infidels, and so on and so on and so on. This guy was a terrorist monster. And the latest thing is, of course, well, he got lap dances. Look, you take hypocrisy, you show me the original religion without any hypocrisy, and I'll change my faith today. I'll sign up. Now, hypocrisy, unfortunately, is part and parcel of religious beliefs, and
yeah.
a good rule is that the more puritanical a religious doctrine, the more hypocrisy it generates, because God gave us all the same biology.
Yep.
So you had some of the hijackers from 11 September 2001 actually had been frequenting strip clubs in Florida and elsewhere. So human beings are very complex, and you can't say, well, he wasn't an Islamist terrorist because he wasn't a perfect saint. On the contrary, he was a mixed-up, screwed-up guy who also believed firmly he was doing his duty as a Muslim by killing American soldiers.
Ralph Peters is here. When you look at the criticism of military tribunals, the only thing that puzzles me a little bit, or I was surprised to see, was that the death penalty, which is part of it, part of a court-martial, part of a military tribunal, it hasn't actually happened. I think it was 1961 the last time.
That's correct. And there are a half dozen people on death row in the military. So the curious thing, again, is that the military tends to be reluctant to enforce a death penalty. I wish we were much tougher about it. So the terrorists, they're actually the civil libertarian leftists, the extremists, who've been crying about Guantanamo. Well, Guantanamo was very generous as a prison, very well run. The prisons those terrorists are going to come to in the United States, whichever one is finally chosen, that prison is going to be much, or prisons, will be much, much tougher. It's not going to be a tropical paradise. These guys are going to learn what prison life is really like. So if there is one single upside to trying them in our country, it's that they're going to lead the life of real prisoners now. Still, the upside is not worth the risk to America, the demonstrations we'll see, the terrorist attacks that will be attempted, small and large. Again, you know, trying these guys, these terrorists in Manhattan is just absolute madness. Now, the interesting thing with Major Hassan, and you raise a good point, even when the military sentences people to death, it's reluctant to execute them. I wish Hassan, Major Hassan, the Fort Hood killer, Fort Hood terrorist, could be tried in a civil court in Texas.
Yep.
Because if he were tried in a civilian court in Texas, that bad boy would be dead in a matter of a few years.
Absolutely. That's the way that it should be. And I want to get in a little bit because our time's limited. We're down to about 5 minutes left with Ralph Peters. Let's talk about Afghanistan. Afghanistan, I'm not saying cut and run. I think we see what the Soviets did there. What we need to do or what the good guys need to do is they need to kick some butt there. Enough of this nonsense. Get in there, destroy the enemy, and it's time to get out because there's no way, in my opinion, that you're going to be able to turn that country around. Your thoughts?
Well, I agree with you. We are trying to nation build where there's no nation to build. We need to remember why we went to Afghanistan in the autumn of 2001.
Yep.
It was to shatter the Taliban and punish those who helped the Taliban. We had accomplished that mission by the late spring, early summer of 2002. And yet, by strange logic, we decided we had to stay on and build a perfect Afghanistan. Well, you're absolutely right, Dana. We're never going to build a perfect Afghanistan because the Afghans don't want what we want them to want. So instead of trying to dissuade Al-Qaeda's Arab terrorists by teaching better dental hygiene to Afghan village elders, I suggest we get back to the original mission. And, you know, and this one, Joe Biden, of all people, is closest to the truth. Let's get back to counterterrorism. We don't want to pull our troops out of Afghanistan.
No.
But I would argue for fewer troops focused exclusively or almost exclusively on defeating our enemies, reaching across the border into Pakistan and hammering them.
Yep.
And secondarily, training those and arming those Afghans who share our values. Because right now we're pretending that Afghanistan is a unified state. It's not. Afghanistan is still in the middle of a very long civil war. And in the civil war, you have to pick your side. We're never going to win over the Pashtuns, the Pathans, the people who are the homeboys of the Taliban, for whom the Taliban's a home team. So let's remember why we went there in the first place. Stop trying to turn Afghanistan into Montana or Minnesota.
Yeah.
And let's concentrate on killing America's enemies.
Absolutely. It's difficult to defend against roadside bombs, but when you're on the battlefield, gun to gun, or you're going to go and blast them with your Air Force or a drone or whatever, it's time they kick some butt.
Right now, so many of our troops are just targets.
Yeah.
They're just rolling around trying to help out Afghan villagers who don't want to be helped, whose relatives are the Taliban, and, you know, the roadside bombs hit them, and I want to know what we get out of it. See, you know, the generals right now, they're presenting the option to Obama of, they're not real options, they're just how many more troops should we send. They're not giving them real choices, just how many troops, Mr. President.
Yeah.
Well, we need to get back and, again, ask ourselves fundamental questions. Why do we go there? Why should we stay there? In what capacity? For strategy, there are three basic questions. The first one is, if we invest our blood and treasure, what do we get out of it? The second one is it doable? Can this be achieved? And the third one is, even if it can be achieved, is it worth the investment? Do we get a positive return on our investment of blood and treasure? And we have not asked those fundamental questions about Afghanistan.
I want to give you the last word and get your thoughts on the morale, and you've touched on it a bit, of the troops with Afghanistan, with Iraq, and the support that they see or lack thereof from the administration, the commander-in-chief. What can we do to try and help our people? You know, they're hearing these stories of the Guantanamo detainees going to Illinois. They'll probably all get Al Jazeera TV in each cell. It's just sickening. I'm concerned about morale. I think that's a big part of it.
Yeah, and certainly it's something you always need to monitor. And troops are very upset about Fort Hood and what happened in general. Casey, the Army Chief of Staff, saying that diversity is more important than what happened at Fort Hood, preserving diversity in the military, which is a nutty saying. But, you know, at the end of the day, our men and women in uniform just do a terrific job. I'm actually amazed that after 8 years of war and constant deployments, morale remains as high as it is on the battlefield. The problem really isn't in combat. They're a band of brothers. The morale is pretty good. They're focused on the day's problems. The problem tends to be at home when they come back, with the families breaking up, divorce rates going up, with the stress. You know, we forget, you know, 8 years of war. I just did an interview with a command sergeant major who had served 42 months, 3.5 years in Iraq. Now, you know, the stress is cumulative.
Yeah.
And this is a different kind of war where there's really not much of a rear area. And we tend to forget that in that wonderful miniseries and book, Band of Brothers,
right,
about the Easy Company from the 101st Airborne, those guys were in combat for a total of 11 months.
Yep.
11 months in a combat zone, part of which they spent in a rear area. We've now got soldiers that have served in combat 4 or 5 times as much as the men of Easy Company and Band of Brothers. So this, while the stress is tough and the military is tired, the Army and Marines are tired, especially the Army, nonetheless, it's a tribute to our stock and our nation that the troops just keep doing their job and doing it well.
Absolutely. One last comment that actually just came in from a listener, and he talks about waterboarding. You know, we hear the government and their disgust with waterboarding, yet we see our troops going through what they're going through right now, and we worry about the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed being waterboarded. And this trial in New York, I think, is going to turn into more about the CIA and George W. Bush being on trial rather than Sheikh Mohammed. I will give you a second last word on that.
Yeah. Well, anybody who thinks waterboarding is full-fledged torture doesn't know anything about torture. We used to waterboard our own pilots and personnel in escape and evasion training, and survival training, basically.
Yeah.
And we obviously wouldn't truly torture our own people. Waterboarding, you know, I'm sure it's not fun for the person being waterboarded, but torture is when you take a knife and peel the skin off someone.
Mm-hmm.
Torture is, you know, electric shocks. Torture is when you do irremediable damage to a human body and soul. I mean, we have got to get over this idea that terrorists have to be pampered. These creatures killed 3,000 Americans.
Yep.
Hey, I want them to answer some questions.
Absolutely. I couldn't have said it better myself. Ralph, thank you, sir.
My pleasure.
Hopefully we can do it again sometime.
God willing.
Okay, bye-bye. That's Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters, Fox News military analyst, someone who knows a lot about what's going on. Some might consider torture watching Keith Olbermann on MSNBC. That's what we should do is... I'm just kidding. We're going to be back here in just a few minutes on Scared Monkeys Radio and talk to Bill Curtis. Who's Bill Curtis? Well, you'll recognize his voice. You'll know him as the host and the narrator of shows like Cold Case Files, Investigative Reports, American Justice, you name it, on A&E. He does those cool cell phone commercials. You know, he's riding in the sidecar. Somebody's been around in broadcasting for 40 years, 20 Emmy Awards, you name it. He's done it. Bill Curtis will be here next on The Dana Pretzer Show. Okay, we're back. And you will recognize, first of all, the voice of my next guest, maybe before you recognize the name. And actually, I shouldn't say that. He's been in broadcasting for decades. He's a 20 Emmy Award winner, or maybe more than that. You'll know him from shows like Investigative Reports, American Justice, Cold Case Files, CBS News. I think he's done a little bit of everything, including those very fun cell phone commercials that you see him on TV riding in the sidecar of the motorcycle. Bill Curtis, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Dana. Good to be here.
You know, I'm a big fan, and I'm going to tell you why just right away. Let's get this right off the bat. When we see crime shows on television today, Bill, and again, you've been around for a long time, what we're seeing besides what you do and maybe America's Most Wanted and a couple of others is we see a bunch of pundits sitting around who are not, you know, who aren't involved in the case, giving their thoughts, giving their opinions, and that's it. You know, we don't hear a lot from the victims. We don't hear a lot from the officers. We certainly don't hear a lot from the accused. But with the work that you do on your shows, you cover all the bases, and that's why, like I say, I'm so impressed, and you do so well with them. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, they're of interest to people. The crime genre seems to be more popular than ever. You have CSI crime shows. I think it's the rise. I call it the new Sherlock Holmes factor. You have DNA. You have forensic tools, the computer age, digital age, that are now able to compare evidence, you know, in a matter of seconds, what took months before. So it's almost a magical kind of solving crime. We deal in a different area, cold cases that aren't solved. So that also has a place. But the process, a lot of our cases are solved, and that's what makes a good story. But the process is really the interesting thing, and what the detectives, the ingenuity that they have to come up with new ways to you know, obtain the DNA samples.
Well, why do you think, Bill, that the public has such an interest, a curiosity, whatever you want to call it, for these sorts of stories?
Well, we're all afraid. It's a combination of curiosity and fear.
Right.
Fear that it could happen to us, curiosity in why people kill. And that story is as old as time itself. From Jack the Ripper back to the caveman days, I'm sure, they were passing around those stories. And today, there we seem to have more of them than ever before. And we were able to shine a spotlight. As a matter of fact, we coined the phrase cold case files, which was, you know, our discovery of this room that every police department has where they send the old-timers or short-timers with about 3 months to go and say, okay, here are the unsolved cases, see what you can do. Well, they started putting the evidence through the new technology, and they started solving these cases.
You know,
so suddenly it was an active room, very active.
And you're right, it is. It's the old guys that go in there, and they kick some butt, and they get the cases solved. If you're just tuning in, Bill Curtis is here. Of course, you know him from Cold Case Files, Investigative Reports, American Justice, you name it, he's done it. What we see today, Bill, with the cable news genre, I guess, and some of the shows that do cover crime stories is the over and over and over and over again reporting, let's just say, the Anthony case. I've covered it here on my show. But it seems like they'll grab a story, they'll run with it 415 times, but there's 1,500 other stories that don't get told, and that's where you guys actually do tell those stories.
Yes. You know, the first of all, the CSI and the majority of the crime shows are fiction. We are real, and we have police departments constantly sending us their cases, and they all seem to be different. Every time, you know, on the news that we said, oh, we got to cut back on the crime coverage, along comes a new case or a very important person requiring us to cover it again. So in our case, fact is truer than fiction and better to understand and follow.
How do you choose which story you're going to cover?
The people, you know, from the police departments will, first of all, give us a list of choices. Then we want to be different. You know, it's a detective in Texas who thinks up a new way to obtain the DNA. First it was sipping out of a glass, then it was taking it off a cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
Of late in Australia, if you'll recall, they had a body, and they were able to identify the body through the serial number on the woman's breast implants.
Yeah.
Then DNA can stay around. We got a conviction here for a murder of 9 people called the Brown Chicken Murders in Palatine, Illinois. They took the DNA off a half-eaten meal of fried chicken. Well, those things are always very, very interesting. So they have to be, in many cases, solved. They have to have this new and different storytelling technique, and we have to have certain access. We have to have visuals. People do have to talk to us. You know, if we wind up facing a dead end from the beginning, then there's no point in pursuing it.
That's a good point. When you look at your career, and you've been in the business a long, long time, and you look at where you are now, and I know how busy you are with many different programs, television, commercials, movie work, you name it. Did you ever think the first time you sat behind a microphone that you would ever be where you are now?
You know, I had a dream to work for or replace Walter Cronkite. I said when I was 17, 18, and I got my first job at a radio station in Independence, Kansas, a little town of 10,000, and the radio station was the only one in town, 250 watts. And, you know, my path was pretty straight. It would move to television on one side, radio on the other, but every job I had pointed in that direction, and that's the advice I would give to young people. If they identify the general area that they're interested in, you may not be able to get the job you desire today. You have to plan for that. You have to educate yourself. You have to, you know, get the experience. But always head in that direction. Don't go off and be a soda jerk or throw bales of hay around. They're good jobs, but they're not relevant to your career path.
You know,
so did I dream of doing what I'm doing now? No, but, you know, over 40 years, you're able to experience the variety of jobs. I've been a local anchorman. I've been a network anchorman. I've been a correspondent for the network. I've been a documentary producer for 20 years. I've narrated 1,000 shows. I've produced 500 of those documentaries for cable, for network. So at this point, I better... And the nice thing is that I can go almost to any one of them and still find that fire in the belly, that little essence that I like. I was just asked to go back to the local station where I worked for, 30 years,
uh-huh.
CBS here in Chicago, and anchor the show with my old co-anchor.
Wow.
He had a ball. It was last Friday. Absolutely had a ball. And, you know, I said, my God, I can do this. Let's get back in the game.
Well, good, good.
My problem is just having so much that I do like and want to do.
Well, good for you. That's fantastic. And you do a little ranching, too, do you not?
I do. As a matter of fact, I started a grass-fed beef company. And it's the new healthy beef. You have a lot of grass-fed beef in Canada. With no chemicals, no antibiotics, no concentrated waste that can get into the aquifer. You know, the methane gas is different, and, you know, we fertilize the fields for next year's crop of grass.
Yeah.
So, it's, and there are unbelievable health benefits. Once you put corn into an animal, it is like putting diesel fuel into your car. It changes the bacteria and the nature of that animal. You know, these cows like buffalo and elephants and are ruminants. They eat grass. They developed stomachs to digest that grass. And, you know, we can speed them up by feeding them corn, but that changes the bacteria inside and allowing E. coli to slip through. So that's a problem in the States these days. And we get no E. coli in grass-fed beef.
Yeah.
And we have elevated levels of omega-3 essential fatty acids, lower levels of saturated fat, it goes on and on. I think it's a sustainable kind of product that I want to be associated with. Green, certainly, good for the environment, the family farmer, and our health. So, yes, I did start tall grass beef.
No, it's very impressive. In fact, where I am, there's a lot of cattle country around here, too. Now, I want to, and again, I really appreciate it if you're just tuning in, Bill Curtis is here. I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the high-profile cases in the news today, get your thoughts on them, how the media is covering them, and let's start with the shooting in Fort Hood and the political ramifications, the terrorist implications, you name it. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, every crime like that, we cover it in stages. First stage is sort of the emergency stage to gather the facts accurately.
Yeah.
What happened? Already there's a discrepancy in who was the hero. The female policewoman who was initially targeted as the person who shot, the gunman.
Right.
But it turns out that she was hit herself, but the guy who put four bullets into him was really the black cop.
Yep.
Who came around the corner from the other side. So, eyewitnesses, we've also learned this in wrongfully convicted cases, eyewitnesses are often not good witnesses because there's an emotional veil and your perspective may not be as clear as you think. So anyway, we have to gather the facts, and those are still coming in, and they will talk to every person there, find out what they saw. It's like the different facets of a diamond. You have to get each one to find out how big it is and what it looks from every different angle. Then you back off to the speculation of, the ramification. How did he, why did he do it? Well, he was part of the jihad. Was he connected with this terrorist Islam mullah, from Yemeni?
Yep.
From Yemen. Well, we now are hearing that he did not instruct him to join the jihad, but he said it's a perfectly acceptable use of the man's efforts, killing all these people. Then you back off, and I'm talking about a couple weeks where the authorities have time to sift through these things and then talk about the political ramifications. And still there are questions unanswered. What effect is it going to have the rest of the Muslim population in the United States? Will there be a backlash? We've had one incident in Chicago. I haven't heard of others, to pay back for this guy who went on a rampage. Second, will there be an effect in the military?
Mm-hmm.
Will Muslim soldiers be prevented from going overseas? Well, their careers are suddenly shortened. They'll be leaving the army. They'll have a bad taste in their mouth. This is America, where everybody is supposed to be free. And if not, how are we going to make sure they don't have an allegiance more to Allah than to the United States military?
Yeah.
And all those questions will now roll out. It's a matter of time. So in our cold case files, we usually pick up the story 6 months to a year out.
Right.
And one of the reasons that it's fresh and, seems new is that we're able to tell the story from beginning to end and with some certainty of what happened, with some accuracy. And people will say, oh, well, I didn't know that, that was the way it happened, because usually they'll get three-minute bursts.
Yep.
On the news. 3 minutes is a long time, or a 30-second burst, and they'll play the same video over and over.
Mm-hmm.
So you are often left to draw the wrong conclusion, and so it's nice to be able to have some analysis, but also, a presentation of facts that's accurate.
Absolutely.
And incidentally, it's no fault of anybody. No fault of the first reporter on the scene, first cops. Truth is just an impossible thing to put together at that early stage.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Last question, Bill, and again, I appreciate your time, and I would be remiss without asking you, because you've covered many cop stories in your career, about Drew Peterson.
It is, for a long time, I thought the evidence was not there to convict Drew Peterson. Oh, you mean Drew Peterson here in Bolingbrook?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. I was intrigued by the sort of what I felt was the overreaching coverage, overkill, of the Drew Peterson case. And I clung to the notion that there wasn't enough evidence to connect him to either murder. I interviewed him in that respect. He had a good story. He comported himself, I think, more as a kind of a haughty, of overconfident, innocent man rather than a guilty guy. And so I don't know the evidence. They apparently have enough that they would charge him. You don't have to have a body to charge somebody with homicide and go to trial. It helps, and this will help the defense if they don't have a body. You know, the bruises that showed up on the autopsy, you know, of his second wife, I guess, were actually, I am told, the size of quarters rather than indicative of large welts and bruises on the body. I've had the Cook County coroner confirm the coroner investigating, you know, the case, that he's excellent, and she would believe him in a minute. So that's the kind of evidence that you're, conflicting evidence that you're going to have to listen to as you go to trial. And I will still say that I think Drew Peterson has a pretty good case. And, you know, the prosecutors there had better have more evidence than what I've seen.
Yeah. No, you know what? And I agree. And the interesting thing about Drew Peterson, Bill, I interviewed him three times on my program. Probably the three most controversial shows I've done in 10 years, but probably three most listened to shows. People want to hear Drew Peterson, even though they hate him. They want to hear him. Listen, I really appreciate the time you've spent with me today, and hopefully we can do this again sometime.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope so, Dana. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Bill Curtis from, you know, American Justice, Investigative Reports, Cold Case Files, you name it. I like the internet commercials or the cell phone commercials that he does on TV. He's voiced movies, you name it. 40 years in the business, 20 Emmy Awards. You know, when I say Bill Curtis, you may not recognize the name, but you certainly recognize the voice. My name is Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. You know, my next guest, Robin Sachs, is a legal commentator, an author, a blog poster at the Huffington Post and Psychology Today, and you name it, she's done it. She also has an interesting, I'll call it a newsletter, called Sachs Facts Weekly, and there's a link on the show notes. Just click it or go to robinsachs.com and sign up to it. I do. You get all sorts of information. She wrote a little, a nice little tribute to Scared Monkeys here the other day, and it's always a pleasure to have Robin on. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Dana. Thank you.
What's going on with Sachs Facts Weekly? You know, I've had you on the show, you know, every week for a couple of years now, or whatever it's been, and I don't think we've talked about it much, but it is it's a good little thing you got going there. Tell us about it.
Well, I appreciate you talking about it, spending some time, because Sachs Facts Weekly, I kind of look at it, I equate my life as a former prosecutor, and the legal word and jargon that we use all the time was discovery. And discovery in the legal sense is something that's a pertinent part of the trial process in which one side seeks to uncover information in order to better prepare themselves from the other side in a case. And what I look at is facts as a form of discovery, discovering things that we need to know that are in the news. There's a whole, you know, as you know, I highlight some, I start with a some sort of, you know, rant. Basically, I look at facts actually as rants and raves. I rant about some issue, some thing, something that's irritated me, pissed me off, made me laugh, highlight an injustice, highlight a good cause or whatever. But then I also try to rave. I lighten it up with the other side of me, and you teased me many times about talking about my, you know, fashion tips and place to great online sites and, you know, how to bake a cake or whatever. Yeah. But truly, in the world of crime that we live in, it's so dark that sometimes you just got to lighten it up with some good website, good find, some good food item, some good something that I end off with. And there's a whole bunch of stuff in between. And more importantly, it's a place and space to highlight the issues like you do. except yeah. they do it in written form.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. I was just teasing you. And you know what? Some criminals would love to have a cake baked with a file in it and sent to them. But and again, folks, go to the link on the show notes, and it'll take you right there. Just click on it, or go to robinsacks.com. Sign up to it. There's no spam. There's nothing. It's free, and you get all this cool information every week. This discovery, as Robin likes to so aptly describe it, and sign up, and you'll join me and many, many, many others with all this information. Anyway, you spent a lot of time here in the last week or so doing TV, talking about things, you name it. We've still got the Fort Hood shooting going on right now. We've got all sorts of other cases that are in the news. Tell us about your media experience this past week. You were on the Joy Behar show. Now, I got to be honest with you, I am not a Joy Behar fan on The View, okay? But I have watched her show on Headline News, and I'm getting converted a little bit, and I don't know what I should think about that. But what were you doing on there?
Well, you know what? Joy shows, it's interesting because I'm not a daytime TV watcher usually. So, although I do know that The View and a lot of the daytime shows tend to have a huge amount of influence in terms of the public.
Right.
It's interesting because I really wanted to dislike Joy just because, you know, she was a little crass and, you know, she got the job that I wanted. So, yeah, I was a little annoyed, you know. But truth be told, she is funny.
Yeah.
She totally, how she appears on TV in real life, she's, you know, this kind of dark and rough sense of humor, but says it like it is. And I ended up there. One thing that's really kind of refreshing is most of the guests, I'd say about 95% of the guests, at least up until this point, must come to New York Live. So it's not something unless you're a crime victim or some other person where you must stay where you are to deal with whatever is at hand. And I suppose if you're Barack Obama, she would take him by satellite too. But everybody else, you really have to be in New York. And just, you know, by happenstance, I was in New York. She has a wonderful production team who I straight out, you know, reached out to. And they were kind and gracious and let me spiel, and albeit about John and Kate, no less. So there I was.
Well, you know what? And as weird as it sounds, and you've met John Goslin, to talk about John and Kate, it seems to be the in thing right now, and it's weird. I just had Bill Curtis on from American Justice and Cold Case Files, and we were talking about, you know, the public's fascination with these sorts of stories, although John and Kate is not really a crime story, although it's a crime to see what they're doing to the children sometimes. They seem to have this, or the people seem to have this fascination with them. I'm not particularly interested in them, but I have to admit, I have watched a little bit, and I wonder, why are the public interested, and why does Robin Sachs go on network television to talk about John and Kate?
Well, the answer is in several words. I'm a self-promotional whore. I'll go wherever they say. So, you know, let's call it like it is. I don't want to, if that's where they want me to weigh in. Do I think that's the best use of my time and my experience? No. Do I think it's the best use of anybody's time caring about them? No. I can't tell you what it is with John and Kate. It's like John and Kate and the Octomom are like the aberration of life to me. I mean, it's, you know, I guess it just really goes to the fact that, you know, people like to watch train wrecks. People, you like issues, you know, real life issues. And that kind of leads me to something that I have found fascinating is in the TV world, and together, we've kind of perused the TV radio scene, and we look at, you know, what does it take to make a show, or what does it take to get media attention? And what the buzz is, from Hollywood at least, is that it's all about characters.
Yeah.
It's no longer about experience per se. It's about what kind of people the person on the tube is. And if there are people that have some sort of definite character, and that's why Nancy Grace does so well, and as if you've watched James Lowe's Mitchell, how she's transformed over the course of the last year, you can see she's become more loud, more outspoken, more involved in the self-help movement to find her character and her role, and it's the characters that seem to be driving the entertainment business, and regular characters, which are cheap and easy and identifiable by all, are the ones that are really getting the leverage.
And exactly. And when you look at that, I want to segue into my last question for you is Mark Furman. He's just come out with a book where he talks about, and he was very negative about the type of reporting that you see on TV, the Nancy Grace style making entertainment out of tragedy. Although I think the title of his book, which slips my mind here right now, is about as hypocritical as anything, because that's what he makes his money on right now, is making entertainment out of crime. Where do you get a Mark Furman, a disgraced former LAPD officer, who comes out now after doing all these crime shows, after doing exactly what he says he's against right now? How do you react to that, someone who was in the court and is doing what Mark Furman says you shouldn't be doing?
Well, I mean, first of all, Mark Furman is a genius, I have to tell you. I mean, he is someone who has turned the worst black mark, and excuse the pun, because that's really awful, but really, the most degrading thing, the most racist person that you could probably, that personifies the worst of law enforcement, and has turned himself into one of the most interesting, intriguing characters on TV. And so he's his own worst example, frankly, of someone who is fascinated. I don't think people give one hoot what he has to say, but they're just dying to hear him say anything to see if there's something that there holds to poke into it. And he's an example of it's all about him. But so I kind of look at him as, you know, that's just another, you know, I don't think anyone looks at what Mark Furman says with any serious credibility. Oh, according to Mark Furman, then this must be so. I think it's, well, let's see what Mark Furman has to say and see where he goes next. And he's, as I said, I think he's a genius. I think that he's probably got a lot of insight, but I think that he is a hypocrite, but I don't think he gives a hoot about that, because that's so. And he's rolling in the money.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you're spot on when it comes to that. What he's criticizing about is what he's actually doing. But when you see this, when you see cable news producer Steph Watts on the program a couple of times now, and it's amazing to see that Steph has gone along my line and started his own radio show, doing what we all do, and that's fine, that's great. But for someone who used to work for Nancy Grace and who used to work for Greta Van Susteren, he is also quick to say the Nancy Gracing of a story, and what he means by that, and he actually explained it on my program, is where the same story, Anthony, Drew Peterson, whatever you want to call it, is covered over and over and over and over and over again, and eventually it gets to the point where, and I'll never forget the conversation between Mark Furman and Greta Van Susteren, and it was so foolish, I did a commentary the next day about it. In fact, I was laughing about how they were debating about a ham sandwich that was in Kaylee Anthony's truck, and it wasn't a ham sandwich, it was actually sliced ham, and they went on for about a 4 or 5 minute segment, and they looked like a couple of it was brutal. So why, where do we get this? Is the Nancy Gracing of stories, the covering over and over again with Leonard Padilla coming on talking about whatever his theory is of this week, a mistake? I do buy into that a little bit, because there are a lot of other stories out there that we're not covering.
Well, that's the problem that you and I have, and thank goodness for shows like yourself, and really thank goodness for you, because you do cover those cases that so badly need media attention. Although, I have to tell you, if it wasn't working and it wasn't getting the ratings, they wouldn't be doing it.
Yep.
So the public is saying that we like this.
Yep.
We want to hear about this. We are, you know, they have a loyal audience. Nancy Grace has a loyal fan base. She does bring, you know, maybe it's repeating the same cases, but she's repeating the same 4 or 5 cases, you know, over a period of time, and they're all the same genre. And, you know, one thing I do kind of notice that happens in the process is that you start to forget who she's talking about sometimes, and what you do realize is that if you were to just kind of forget about the actual child, as horrific as that sounds, and think about the reminder that she's at least reminding us that we need to think about the children, and that we need, and reminding us of the evils that people can do to children and so forth, then, and look at the greater good and get over the fact that, you know, Casey Anthony has been beaten to a pulp 100,000 times over again, and get over that, she is highlighting a very important issue. And if we look at the issue, I have to give kudos to her for doing that.
I do, too. And I've criticized her in the past, but I also respect her time as a prosecutor. She's a crime victim, and she does help. That's the important thing. Robin Sachs, her Sachs Facts Weekly is available at robinsachs.com. Sign up to it. You won't regret it. See you next week, kiddo.
Can't wait. Take care, hon. Bye-bye. Okay,
bye-bye. That's Robin Sachs, former ADA at Los Angeles County. That's it. That's tonight's show. Hope you enjoyed it. Our webpage is scaredmonkeysradio.com, www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. Check it out. Let us know what you think. We'll see you again real soon here on the Dana Pritzer Show.
You've been listening to the Dana Pritzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.